dancers will tell you, the graceful, lighter-than-air performances we adore are a kind of illusion. If they're successful, they divert the attention of the audience entirely away from the agony dancers experience performing on mangled legs or injured feet, and from the sacrifice required by years of grueling training. All we see is what is beautiful. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We may each seek beauty from different sources. Maybe you crave an amazing wardrobe or an exquisite home, a collection of rare minerals or impressionist paintings. But wanting to experience beauty is universal among humans, and the drive to possess what we find alluring can tempt us to overlook the cost of our appetites. Writer Katie Kelleher is a contributor to the Paris Review and author of the new book, The Ugly History of Beautiful Things, Essays on Desire and Consumption. Katie, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's so great to be back.
You share here that depression and beauty both are central factors in your life. What do they have to do with one another?
Well, for me, depression is something that I've long struggled with ever since I was, I'd say, maybe a teenager or a little girl. I've known that there were parts of my brain that were not working the same way that other people's brains worked. Often I would feel incredible anxiety or sadness at times where, you know, there was really nothing to be sad about. And for a long time, I struggled with this and I struggled to hide it. I worked really hard to keep this part of myself, invisible from the people around me. And when I finally did start seeking help for my, mental illness, I had a therapist who once kind of sat me down and asked me, like, all right, you say everything is so bad. You say you feel so bad. You say that, you know, you don't even know if you want to live. Then why do you keep living? You know, what keeps you going? And no one had ever asked me that so directly. And I started to think, you know, of course, my family, my friends, all of those things that make life worth living. But another thing that bubbled up for me was beauty, that I find so much pleasure and so much sense of connectedness to the natural world when I am experiencing beauty and when I'm in a beautiful landscape or when I'm looking at a beautiful painting or seeing a beautiful work of art that makes me feel very connected to human history. I realized for me, beauty was something that it didn't cure my depression. I think that would be, you know, a huge overstatement, but it gave me a portal of hope, you know, a new space that I could carve out for myself and a new way of inhabiting the world that was really hopeful and positive.
So for you, does beauty penetrate a deep depression or does it just give you reason to hold out until you are able to pull out of that depression?
I think it can do a bit of both. You know, when I've been in really deep depressions in the past, it has been hard to see any beauty, but there also have been times where I've been able to pull myself out of it. And one of the things I always do when I'm feeling blue that I've learned really works for me is I go for a swim. To be immersed in water, especially cold water. I live in Maine, so cold water is abundant. And immersing myself in the Atlantic Ocean, no matter what time of year, there's something so immediately shocking and life-affirming about that. Plus, the Atlantic Ocean is beautiful, and you get in it, and you just look out at the water, and there's something about it that can jolt me back into myself. And that's something I talk about a lot in the book, that beauty can have a power of recentering you in the moment, taking you outside of anxieties or concerns or depression and taking your focus on your senses. And I think that that is a very powerful thing.
So many of us experience beauty with these vast things like the ocean. Most of us also want to possess beautiful things. Why does that sometimes feel like a troubling urge to you?
Well, because when do you have enough? You know, that is something that is very unclear, I think, to most of us, because For many people living in America, our material needs are met. We have food. A lot of people have food and shelter and, the immediate things. Once those needs are met, the desire to accumulate things that you want, it's not clear when one should stop. I mean, we see outrageous wealth, and it's often presented in media as, just sort of the natural way of things, that the wealthier you get, the more you have, and that there really shouldn't be a stopping point. One of the things I try to argue in my book is that there absolutely should be a stopping point, that you should figure out when to stop having things, because to constantly accumulate more material goods is contributing to a cycle that is, really bad for our planet and is destroying the beauty of our planet.
So something that I find beautiful and have a small collection of are spheres, right? I have stone spheres and crystal ones. I love everything about them. And I have always thought of that as just a quirk of my personality. But reading your book, it also occurred to me that I might not have known that I wanted those things if I hadn't seen the first one for sale in a store somewhere. Is it possible for any one of us to separate our personal desires from what marketing and culture encourage us to find beautiful?
I mean, I don't think so. I don't think one can exist outside culture. I think that we are social creatures. We're born into society and we live within it. And that is in general a really wonderful thing because it allows us all these connections, and all of these moments of, human joy and recognition that we're similar. And when we build culture, we build it together. It's something that all of humanity is partaking in all the time. We're all building our various cultures. And I don't believe you can really get outside of it. But what you can do is you can recognize which temptations are coming from culture, which ones are coming from maybe a part of culture that feels particularly nefarious to you. Like there's certain elements of marketing that I find, pretty disturbing. And once you recognize that and kind of figure out, like, okay, well, why do I want this? What is drawing me toward it? It gives you a little bit more power of choice to either, indulge that desire for beauty and that desire to, collect, be close to something, to create a collection is a wonderful thing, and to do that can be really fun and satisfying. But it's also, I like to know why I'm collecting. And I'm kind of curious, have you ever thought about why spheres? Like, what is it about that form that draws you?
I think they're visually beautiful when they're made out of stone. They're often veined and interesting in the way that interesting stones are. And then I love the way they feel. Most of them are just a little larger than palm sized. I love the way they feel in my hand.
Yeah, there's something both visual and tactile about that. I think that's another thing about really beautiful things. Often they feed more than one sense.
And this is a point that you make in the book that I think is really interesting. You note that it can feel like we're doing something creative when we buy things to collect them, but that's actually not the same thing as creativity.
Yeah, and that's a hard one for me too, because I love clothes and I still love to shop. And even now, I still will, when I'm feeling like a little bit of anxiety or pressure, I still tend to open up a like, the RealReal app on my phone or Poshmark or one of these resale sites because I try to buy secondhand. But I'll open it up and I'll find myself scrolling through. And it feels like I'm doing something creative, like I'm curating an outfit, I'm creating a style. And in a way, that can be creative. Putting together an outfit can be a creative act. But it is not quite as generative or creative as taking out watercolors and, mixing a few colors, trying to create a painting, or not even really as creative as standing over your stove and cooking something interesting. I mean, that requires more, it requires more like ingenuity, it requires a little bit more creative thinking than just buying something. That is a desire fulfilled. It's a very transactional, And I think there's a lot more interesting beauty that can be found when you step outside the transactional.
During the pandemic, I mean, no one would accuse me of being like a fashion plate or someone who has just exquisite taste. But, you know, I like new clothes as much as the next person. But I was surprised to note during the height of the pandemic, I was going into work every day, but the building was mostly empty. So it was me and like 9 other people in this giant building. And my desire for clothes dropped off to nothing. Now, I wasn't staying home, but there weren't any people to notice if I got some cool new shoes or something. And I thought about whether this sense I have of the beauty of clothes is also a little bit performative.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned at the top of the show, you know, dance is a performance, and it is a beautiful performance. There is a lot of beauty to be found in human performance. Music is something that I didn't write about in this book, but it is something I considered writing about, because music is an area where you can find great moving, awe-inspiring, and emotional beauty. And it can, you know, that can come at a cost too. That can be, you know, a complicated and strange thing. So I think discounting the idea of performance, it would be impossible. You know, you can't remove the idea of performance entirely from beauty. And performance is not bad. That's another thing I want to be very clear about with my book, is that like, it is not bad to want to embody beauty or perform beauty or enjoy it or be close to it. These are all really like wonderful, normal things that can feel really wonderful and can feel really life-giving. But they also are not constantly necessary. I think clothing, you know, is one way of performing beauty. So is makeup. You know, a lot of things we do to ourselves with makeup and, you know, hair and all of these sort of personal grooming things, the way we scent ourselves with perfume, these are all ways of publicly performing beauty and trying to embody beauty. And I think that is a normal thing. But once it feels like a pressure, once it feels like a cage, you know, once it feels like someone is making you do it, it can become really dark. So I think clothes and all of those other things, you know, they all kind of exist in the same realm of performing, embodying, and being beauty. And I think that is a really tricky one to approach.
It can be hard to know where the line is too, right? Between performing and doing something for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes and as you mentioned, you know, you only noticed when there was no one around, you know, that maybe you were doing that as a performance. You know, it can be very difficult. And very rarely, I think, you know, I don't think most people want to embody beauty purely for themselves. I think we're social creatures and we like being seen, and that is fine. You know, that is not a bad thing. It's good to feel seen, and it is good for people to feel beautiful. But the idea of being beautiful all the time is incredibly silly and impossible.
You note here, Katie, that most people are drawn to mirrors. We're drawn to our own reflections. Why do we have a hard time admitting this?
I think there's been a long campaign to make people feel bad about the very natural impulse of wanting to know what you look like. I think that there is an idea that vanity is, you know, a particularly bad sin and a particularly silly thing. And yet appearance matters a lot. What we look like affects our job prospects, it affects our mating prospects, it affects our lives in some really tangible and important ways. So the mirror is a useful tool so that you can see yourself how society sees you. That's a piece of information that is worth knowing. And yet I think it's very easy to dismiss that as vanity or shallowness and to pretend that those things don't matter.
And I think, you know, whenever we're pretending that something doesn't matter, that clearly does, I think it's always good to ask, well, who's benefiting from that?
Mirrors have been associated with magic over time. What have you learned about that?
Well, one of the things I loved doing was I was able to talk to the archaeologist who found some of the earliest mirrors that we know of in a site in Turkey. It was this proto-urban settlement. So it was this really interesting mud kind of city where people built houses on top of each other. And he found these ancient obsidian mirrors that had been made out of stone and ground down and polished. And the backs were painted and plastered. And these mirrors were very small. You could hold them in your hands, and they were often placed in corners, and they were placed in the tombs, usually of women. And these mirrors, they came to believe, were probably used for everyday purposes, like applying makeup, because they were also buried in places with, you know, jars of makeup and cosmetics. But they were also likely used in religious rites, like scrying. There is a long history of looking into mirrors or reflective surfaces to try to see something either in the future, in the past, or in another world. And this is something that people have been doing across cultures, across the world. It's really kind of wonderful that this is something that like humans do and animals do. You know, we see animals see a reflection and they immediately are curious. They don't know what they're looking at. And the sense of what could it be, I find, you know, really kind of exciting and beautiful. I mean, I also have had a baby, and when you have a baby, you get to see them encounter their reflection for the first time, and there is nothing more fun than seeing a baby look at it and go, oh, "Is that me?" And I just think that's, I don't know, it's a low-key miracle.
We're obsessed, humans are obsessed with gemstones and especially diamonds, but for most people, they're not so beautiful in their natural state, right? They have to be cut and polished first.
Yeah, that's something that was I was really interested to learn about is how many gemstones we have that we think are just like pulled out of the earth and look like this. Like they look like very different in their natural state. You know, they look very unimpressive. And diamonds look just sort of like gray hunks of dirty stone. But also things like tanzanite. I mean, it comes out of the earth in this sort of like Coca-Cola brown color. And it's not until you heat it and treat it with pressure that it turns into this amazing violety purple. There are so many examples of gemstones that we make beautiful, and yet we prize them for what we suppose are their natural qualities. And that is especially true with diamonds because we have now the ability to make lab diamonds that are chemically indistinguishable from the diamonds grown in the ground, but we don't want them, you know, not at the same level.
Yeah, they don't have this mystique, this story, which, you know, we should note to folks that the story is very much a fiction, right? Of the rarity of diamonds and what makes them so special.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are diamonds, there are plenty of diamonds in the world, and diamonds have been being held back off the market by the, you know, by De Beers, by the great diamond company, for over a century. You know, they hold them out of the market to raise the price artificially to create an illusion of scarcity. And another thing that has worked very well for diamond companies and diamond sellers is the very famous slogan, "A diamond is forever." That slogan is really genius because it ties diamonds to the idea of eternity, which makes them the perfect thing for a commitment, a lifelong commitment, like an engagement ring. But it also, this, and this is the part people don't think about as much, it also really suppresses the resale market. Because if it's a diamond is forever, you don't want someone else's diamond. You don't want to resell that. You don't want to get rid of it. So there's been a really kind of amazing process of myth making around a diamond that helps encourage people to spend way too much money on them, hold on to them, not buy them secondhand, and
to treat them like the one and only option when really there's plenty of wonderful stones you could wear for jewelry.
And to be clear, we think of them as really valuable because they're special, and special because they're valuable. But pretty much any diamond we buy at retail loses value faster than like an entry model Ford we drive off the dealer
Absolutely.
lot.
Yeah, the minute you walk out the door, the moment you buy it, it loses so much of its value. But yet we keep buying them, and I have a ring with some diamonds in it, like diamond chips. So I'm not above it all. I see the appeal of them, and there's something there is there are certain qualities of diamond that it should be mentioned are beautiful. I mean, the way that light reflect ref, the way that light is reflected and refracted inside the diamond due to its chemical structure, its tetrahedral structure is really remarkable. It creates a rainbow, which they call diamond fire. Not all stones can do that. Different stones have different chemical structures, and a lot of them cannot wink like a diamond winks. And that's, it is awe-inspiring. It's also very cool how hard they are. They have a great utility when it comes to sharpening knives and in industrial purposes. But we often don't really think about that either. It's instead, we prefer to think about this myth of like this rare, beautiful stone that lasts forever, that has these innate qualities, and that you give to someone you love.
And separate and apart from, the pain that might be caused by the fact that we pay more for these objects than they're probably empirically worth, there's a whole lot of human suffering wrapped up in the diamond industry, at least in parts of Africa.
Yeah, and that has been true since, the beginning of diamond mining in Africa. I mean, some of the earliest mines used convict labor camps, and primary source documents from the time show that these were horrific places, like really horrific places, where the workers were kept in cells. They were often kept naked, chained to the wall. They're often kept wearing restrictive leather mittens at all times when they weren't mining, because they didn't want them to have any way of stealing any gemstones. And they were also subjected to invasive bodily searches to make sure that they had not stolen any diamonds and put them anywhere on their body. So that's some of the earliest mines in Africa were like that. They were run like that. Later on, we have the history, the well-documented history of the blood diamonds and diamonds that are used to fund conflict. So diamonds, they have a very bloody history because the corporations that were selling these stones cared a lot more about profits than they did about the people, and especially the people in Africa. It is possible now to buy ethical diamonds. There, if people are looking for diamonds that are, certainly not blood diamonds, you can buy Canadian diamonds, you can buy diamonds from the US. There are some that are certified. De Beers has created a system of diamond certification. So it is possible to do that now. They did respond to this, and many other jewelers and diamond companies responded to this. But it's something worth thinking about, I think, when you're going to buy an engagement ring.
So, Katie, you write about the cut flower industry, and it's so ironic here that making roses in particular hardy enough to last for weeks of transportation and storage and then a few days of display, this caused botanists to breed out the beauty of the scent of a lot of these roses.
Yeah, it is wild. One of the most interesting places I've been was I went down to Miami to see where most of the flowers that come into the US from Ecuador and other South American countries, I went to see where they come through, where they're inspected. And I got to go into these huge hangars full of roses, and these roses had been shipped over in refrigerator crates or flown over, and they were just identical. There were thousands upon thousands of them, and they smelled like absolutely nothing. You know, it smelled like a refrigerator and some light chemicals in there. It did not smell like you were within a massive room packed to the brim of boxes of flowers. And that's really where it hit me that, like, this is just another mass marketed thing. This is just another mass produced object. You know, it's not, these roses are not living flowers that are bred to, you know, reproduce themselves. They're bred to be cut and sold and die. And that's, you know, not the end of the world, but I have come to really prefer the ones that you can find by the beach in Maine that smell like really fragrant, you know, Rosa rugosa.
Is there something, do you think, about the fragility of roses, the evanescence of any cut flower, that contributes to our experience of their beauty? Are they more beautiful to us because we know they will only be beautiful for a week or maybe a few days more?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of the, like, Dutch still life painters of the 17th century used flowers in their memento mori paintings. They often depicted flowers that were just a bit past their prime as a way of telling the viewer, remember, you're gonna die. There's something about the fleeting beauty of it and the way you can see the decay so clearly, minute to minute almost, that I think is, you know, a very good reminder that life fades, that things fade, and that aging and decay is part of life. I also think that there's something about flowers as they slightly go off that makes their scent a little bit more intense. And a lot of perfumers, what they're trying to capture isn't just like the scent of a really fresh flower. They're trying to capture the scent of a slightly off flower because there's a little bit more jolt to it. There's a little bit more dirt to it. And there's something about that that, you know, draws us in. You know, we want to look a little closer. We want to sniff it. We want to know it a bit better because there's something about that that I think is really alluring.
So these things marketed as eternity roses, everything about them is static, right? The way they look, I don't know if they have a scent added, but none of that will change over time.
No, and there isn't a scent added. I bought a box of them to see what they were like. There was no scent added. They were dyed an unnatural turquoise color, which, I mean, that was my own bad taste in choosing that. But they felt like paper. You know, they felt papery. They were no more interesting. I mean, in fact, they were, to me, a lot less interesting than a paper or silk or even plastic flowers. Their veins had been filled with, you know, some embalming fluid and wax. And yeah, they looked, from a slight distance, they looked like fresh roses, but they didn't feel like it. They didn't have that, you know, that really velvety feeling that you get from like a nice rose petal. And they didn't smell like anything. They just kind of sat there and they collected dust.
I'm glad you threw them. I'm glad you brought up the tactile thing because I really like touching flowers gently. There's something about that, but we almost never talk about that experience.
Yeah, and that's something that I think is really underrated when it comes to beauty. That a lot of beauty is experienced with, you know, all of our senses or more than one sense. Flowers are tactile and lovely, and there's difference. You know, I garden, so right now my daffodils are going crazy, and a daffodil petal feels different than a rose petal. You know, it has little ridges on it and it has little ruffles, and touching them and is another way of knowing them. You know, it's another form of information. And it's another way to heighten the experience of it. And I think we often forget, because I think so often we think of, you know, touching as potentially ruining something, or, I mean, you can't touch the paintings in a museum, right? And there's also a sense that touch is somehow a little unseemly to talk about, the pleasure that you get from touching, as though it's automatically like sexual and not just sensual. But touch is a really wonderful form of, it's a wonderful sense. It's a wonderful form of information gathering, and you use it all the time when we don't even think about it. You use touch and scent and hearing to navigate the world, and yet we don't often privilege them as highly as we privilege vision.
Katie, forgive me for making the world's worst segue here, but you write about the fact that for a while in the 19th century, there was this sort of consumption chic, tuberculosis chic fashion that took hold among young women. What was that about?
Yeah, I found that really fascinating. This was, it was a time period where there was a lot of sort of repression around sex and a lot of denial around sex. And there was also, the romantic period was happening in literature and art, and there was a real interest in the beautiful dead woman, the beautiful dead figure. Edgar Allan Poe once wrote that there's nothing more beautiful than a beautiful dead woman. And I think there was a desire to be, women saw this, they were immersed in culture, and they responded by wanting to look pale and sickly and trying briefly to look like they were, on death's door. By, making themselves look paler than they are, with their sunken eyes, a sort of like bedclothes look. And I think there's something about it that really heightened the femininity and the, or really played on the idea that women are by nature frail and fair, and these sort of wilting little lilies that need protecting. Which fed into the gender politics of the day. And it was weird. I mean, it's a fashion. Any fashion's weird, but it's also not something that's totally gone away. There's still a lot of there's still a lot of people, there's still a lot of young women who are interested in looking, like coquettes, looking younger. Looking childlike and looking somehow frail, which I think is it's an ongoing thing, and it's definitely worth interrogating.
Yeah, there is this inescapable, if subtle, message that the way to be the most womanly woman is to what, die young and escape the indignities of getting old and allegedly losing beauty.
I mean, I think that's part of it, either. It sometimes it can feel like there are two paths for women. You can either freeze yourself in time or you can die. Sometimes it can feel like that. And that is just a feeling, because there's of course many paths women can take. And aging and embracing the fact that your body is aging and you will age is one of them. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do. It's a wonderful thing to see. We just don't have as many models for it, and we don't tend to praise it as often in contemporary culture.
Do you see growing pressure on men? I mean, I'm fascinated by the number of cosmetics now marketed, especially to young men, and hair removal devices. And I feel like marketing is starting to catch up when it comes to pressuring men to look a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, I think when there is a new market, which is, young men who are a little less afraid of makeup than they used to be, then marketing will find a way to sell products to that group. And I think that's something we're seeing. And part of the thing about a lot of these pressures is a lot of the pressures are created by the company selling you the solution. The idea that you have to look a certain way is often created by a magazine that is also selling you the product that is going to help you to look that way. So, of course, if we can get men buying them, well, then why wouldn't you want that? I mean, that would just sell more product, which would keep the economy going. You know, the more people feel they lack things, the more they will buy. So that pressure, you know, I think there's a very real, there's a reason to induce that pressure on young men. And there's a reason to want young men to spend their money on this.
It's such an interesting conundrum because on the one hand, yes, there's pressure on people to look a certain way. There's this maybe desire that we have to feel like we look beautiful. There's the sense that beauty can create a certain kind of confidence. And then there's also the reality that beautiful people, by and large, are treated better than people who don't strike us as so attractive.
Totally. And I think that there's also one of the things that I found kind of inspiring when I was researching the history of makeup was learning that for so long, cosmetics were considered a part of health. That to beautify was often, you know, part and parcel, like they were the same. Medicine and cosmetics were the same thing. To have clear skin was a sign of healthy skin. And that's not always necessarily true. I mean, plenty of people have scars and other things that, you know, there's nothing unhealthy about that. But, you know, there is something nice about taking care of your body as though you are taking care of its health and wellness, rather than trying to artificially beautify. And that's a hard line to draw. You know, where does one end and another begin? What is for wellness and what is for beauty? Or, you know, how do you untangle those things? I don't really know, but I do know that certain things, certain acts feel good when I do them. You know, putting on lotion when my skin is really dry can feel really good. And making that into a little ritual where it's, you know, I sit in front of my space heater in the winter and warm my lotion and put it on, it feels good. You know, it makes your body feel good and nourished and treated well. And sometimes putting a little color on your face can make you feel really genuinely good. I think figuring out what it is that actually feels good and what it is that feels like, oh, I should do this, otherwise people will think this of me. I think that is the way I'm trying to figure out how to go forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the book really just presents so many interesting things for us to think about that don't have easy answers. In the section about beauty and, you know, you just mentioned wellness, I think about the modern wellness industry, and it's been criticized elsewhere. We won't go into that here. But sometimes I wonder if this pressure, you know, if this sense that looking sort of beautiful is supposed to look these days like looking just strong and healthy, if that doesn't put a lot of pressure on people who are not strong and healthy, whose bodies are sick.
Yeah, it does. You know, I think it probably does. And I think there's elements of it that, you know, there's elements of beauty culture and of physical beauty that will always be painful because I don't think that everyone is beautiful. I mean, I think that some bodies are more beautiful than others. And that's just the way of the world. I mean, that's just what beauty is. You know, if everyone was beautiful, no one would be beautiful. That doesn't mean that not everyone can be seen as beautiful at times, or that people will have beautiful qualities. And most importantly, that doesn't mean that people who maybe are not beautiful are less worthy. It doesn't mean that they are less virtuous. It doesn't mean anything else than maybe their physical features aren't as harmonious as someone else's. You know, it is not, I think the best thing we can possibly do when it comes to physical beauty is pay less attention to it, you know, and just recognize that like it has some power, its power is limited, and it is not the be all end all.
Do you look differently at people who strike you as physically beautiful when you're seeing them through like a digital image?
Oh, that's interesting. I think so. I mean, honestly, at this point, when I see a digital image of someone who's physically beautiful, I just assume it's monkeyed with in some way.
Right.
It's been filtered, or it's, I mean, it's flat. It's so much harder to actually parse what's there. And it's so, I don't know, I tend not to be attracted to or particularly interested in beautiful pictures of people that I see on a screen. Not that I can't like appreciate a movie star that looks good, but like, it's not like when you're with somebody and you notice that they have a really beautiful quality or really great hair or something, you know, there isn't the presence to it, that draws me in. So it's hard to say, you know, it's beauty on a computer screen exists, but it's a different type of beauty. And it definitely, at least for me, it evokes a very different kind of reaction.
I want to talk about smelling beautiful. Components of traditional perfumes, musk and ambergris and civet, these are all animal products. How often do we have to hurt or kill another living thing to extract these things?
Thankfully, these days, not very often. At this point, we have some pretty good laws in place that protect animals from having their butts prodded until they're, you know, excreting their little civet discharge. So we don't do that as often anymore. There are still perfumes on the market that do use some natural animal molecules, but mostly we have synthetics, and we have some very good synthetics. Weirdly, though, we have created a world where we are almost constantly smelling some form of synthetic musk. It is the most commonly used fragrance. It is in everything from laundry detergent to lotion. A lot of the things that we think smell just like clean actually smell like fake musk, which is, I think, so fascinating that, you know, this is something that used to be collected from a small little a gland inside, you know, the rear of a deer, and they would take it out and it would have to dry out in the sun, and they would extract the musk from this. And now we have, you know, this handy dandy little chemical that you can put in anything.
How has this project shaped the way you seek beauty in your life?
This project has ruined some things for me. Certainly, it has changed how I shop for clothing in really big ways. You know, it has reduced my consumption of clothing. It has also led me to make a pact to buy secondhand almost exclusively. But it has not ruined as many things as I think as maybe I thought it would when I was starting out. Because as I worked on this, as I read about the history of beautiful things, and as I read about the different things that people have loved and treasured throughout human history, I started to gain a lot wider of a sense of appreciation. I started to be able to see qualities that maybe previously I hadn't particularly paid attention to. One of the things that I now find really beguiling and just and really lovely that I never really thought about before was iridescence. I mean, it's in the natural world all the time. And it's in so many things that we consider beautiful, from stones to feathers to, you know, water. We're constantly seeing these like kind of glimmers of light, you know, these little sparkles. And it's so easy to just walk by it. But once I started to really think about it, I started to realize that like so much of the beauty that we cultivate and build is trying to capture that sense of a glimmer on water or the twinkle of a star, you know, that the way light plays and moves and the playfulness of it. You know, there's something about that that is really has become really moving to me, to the point where, you know, when I find it in like a, you know, broken piece of shell that like has that glint and color, that I can now have an experience of beauty that I used to need more. It's just like learning to train your nose to smell perfumes and to understand different perfumes. You can train your eyes to see beauty where you didn't before, and you can train your ears to hear music in a way that you didn't.
Katie Kelleher is a contributor to the Paris Review and author of The Ugly History of Beautiful Things, Essays on Desire and Consumption. Katie, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Find us on Facebook and Instagram, or get the podcast wherever you get podcasts, or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.